Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now, many of the big issues facing 21st century society have scientific dimensions. And if we are to learn from experiences like COVID, and if we are to survive the effects of climate change, we must consider the way society engages with science, the role of experts and our trust in them. Well, here to talk to us about public trust and scientific expertise is physicist Dr. Shane Bergen from the UCD School of Education, who has published a new podcast on this very topic, and it's called The Trust Race. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
To see you. So you're going to talk to us all about this, and congratulations on the podcast. So what makes a scientific expert trustworthy at a very basic level?
Well, we could take a step back and ask what makes any expert trustworthy, right? Be it your doctor, your plumber, radio presenter or scientist. There are certain attributes that we can look at. So the first thing is like their education and their training, so their background and their credentials and their experience, simple things, you mm-hmm. know. And I think all of that is very simple to ascertain if you're talking about a plumber or even your doctor, where the fix is rather immediate. But when it comes to things that are a little bit more abstract, like science, establishing trust in scientific expertise is a little bit more tricky. And so we have to look and see, is the person acting ethically? Do they have conflicts of interest? Why are they giving the view that they're giving? In other words, you always ask that question, what do they stand to get from the point of view that they're putting forward? I think in recent years, we've seen like a plethora of experts coming forth on lots of topics. And there has been a bit of a pushback to say, do you know what? There's just so many of them and so many of them disagree with each other. I'll just do my own thing. That doesn't work, right? For the same reason that you can't extract your own tooth or perform surgery on yourself, you need to rely on experts in order for you to get through life. That requires a leap of faith. You have to trust them. What I'm suggesting and what other experts are suggesting, experts on experts, is that you shouldn't do that blindly. That you should really think about the experts that you're interacting with in your life and figure out whether you should trust them or not. And I would always say that you should incline towards trust. There is a leap of faith involved, and that you should basically give people the benefit of the doubt, but be somewhat skeptical as you go.
Yes, and we saw that a lot, didn't we, during the pandemic on social media. I've done my own research and therefore I'm not going to do X or I am going to do Y. And the reason, I suppose, one of the reasons why that happens is that trust is hard to build, but it's really easily broken, isn't it?
It's so easily broken. And, you know, I'm a scientist, and all it takes is for a handful of scientists amongst the thousands in the world or hundreds in Ireland to break that trust for the public to rightly be suspicious of us all. And so when trust is broken, it's very hard to rebuild it. But I think that trust is crucial because, as you said at the start, the big issues that face our society have a strong scientific dimension, but they also involve people and people making trust. And it is essential that we can create a climate of trust if we are to survive things like climate change. And so I'm really interested in scandals and controversies that have impacted our trust in science and figuring out what can we learn from them. You know, there's this whole debate at the moment about the COVID inquiry. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a feeling that it could turn into, well, here's the people that did the things wrong, right? And we want names and we want heads to roll, that kind of logic. I think that that's a disastrous way to approach it. I think we really need to see what can we learn from COVID that we could apply to other socio-scientific issues. What can we learn from COVID, which was, in the grand scale of things, a small emergency compared to what climate is going to be like in the next century? So in other words, how did we use expertise? How do we interact with all those people? What can we get from it that we can do the next emergency better?
Okay, now you mentioned COVID, so we'll start with that and masks. And we're going to take a listen to a clip now from your podcast. And this is with Professor Heather Douglas from Michigan State University.
Then combine that with, you know, a president like Trump, who is just, I'm not wearing that. Americans viewed it as sort of like an impersonal imposition. And instead of saying, like, look, there are all kinds of things we do for public good that also help protect us. We chlorinate drinking water, we treat it, And we have speed limit signs, and we require driver's licenses. There are all kinds of these public goods. Americans are really bad at talking about public goods, and it seems like there's always a subset of any given society that's very suspicious of public goods.
Straight in with the controversial one, the mask wearing. That became so contentious, didn't it?
It did, yet for something that's so simple, right? That you wear a mask to stop breathing out the virus or inhaling it. But it became a political thing. Mm-hmm. And I was very interested as to how that happened. How could something that's so obviously effective become so polarizing?
Well, some experts were in here telling us that they weren't sure how effective they were, and, you know, weren't sure about the value of them, and people would have dirty hands and they'd be shoving them in their pockets and putting them back on and they'd be useless as a result.
Absolutely. And so we didn't know the science fully at the start, and the science evolved as the pandemic evolved. So we knew nothing much about how COVID was transmitted at the start, but we quickly figured that out. Yet there was a legacy then from that, right? So because we weren't sure who to believe, we kind of adopted this, or it was easy for us to adopt positions of going, do you know what? They keep changing their mind. I'm just going to do my own thing. Where what could have happened is we could have done a better job in explaining how science works, right? And in other words, how the research is evolving and how the experts change with the research. Mm-hmm. And I think that also advice around mask wearing wasn't always given on the right basis. So at the start, really, we were told to not wear masks because the healthcare officials were worried we'd run out of masks, right? So instead, we were just told, oh, we're not so sure. We can't really trust you to the mom correctly. So maybe just leave it for the time being. And that wasn't the right basis. If people had been a little bit more honest and forward with their reasons for hesitancy, we might have said, look, they don't know right now. We'll have to wait and see what they say. But yet every scientist was being asked back in April 2020, you know, should you wear a mask? Should you not wear a mask? A yes or no answer. And then that kind of led into all the confusion. And it was perfect for those who are political actors who wanted to take advantage of that division and to wedge in their politics into it.
But in order to get consensus, you'd have to have all of those experts agreeing. And that's rarely going to happen, is it?
Well, that's how science works. So we have a process, the peer review process. It can take time. Now, it had massively accelerated during COVID, and the rate at which science was done during the pandemic was incredible. To think that the virus was first spoken about in late 2019 and we had vaccines for it with it a little over a year and a half later, and we very quickly figured out how the virus was transmitted and how it could be blocked, etc. There is virtually no scientist now who will say that masks aren't effective. Mm-hmm. You know, that there's consensus now, and it didn't take that long for consensus to emerge. So it was really about how do we deal with science stories when the science is evolving?
Okay, now you looked into the HIV/AIDS crisis back in the 1980s and how science ignored people's suffering.
Yeah.
What happened there?
Well, as a scientist, kind of one of the things that draws me in is this idea that it's for the common good, right? That the work we're doing in our labs is for everyone's benefit. But of course, like, that's not really always that true, because we're people at the same time. You know, I'm a scientist, but I'm also a human. So I have all the biases that any other human can have. And we saw back in the 1980s how homophobia effectively stopped or delayed research into AIDS, HIV. This was at a time when the New York Times wasn't able to publish the word gay. Right. So people were dying in their hundreds, if not thousands. And it took people in that community to step up or to act up. Sarah Shulman is somebody I spoke to for the podcast, and she spoke about community or grassroots organizations that had to lobby and protest to get politicians and to get scientists to take it seriously, that basically it wasn't some sort of, you know, disease that was given to them because they were gay, and this was a serious thing, and that research needed to be done to help people and to stop them from dying. Mm-hmm. And it worked. It did work. So we can now see, like it's 40 something years ago, we can now see the effects of that community activism and how it changed science policy.
And the horror of treatments being available at that time for some of the symptoms, certainly in the beginning,
yeah,
not being made available to people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because of that bias.
Yeah, and it still exists. So you can see that there's talk at the moment in the UK around, you know, the NHS provides healthcare to people there. And there's a drug you can take called PrEP, which is something that can prevent you or lower the risk of you contracting HIV. And so the NHS now offers that drug, but there was massive pushback from right-wing media around it being offered because it was basically saying, you know, we'll give this drug on the NHS and people are going to go out there and be really promiscuous and have sex with lots of people. And the way they framed it in the media was, if you give that drug to LGBT people or anyone else, then we're going to have to take money away from other people. And they picked cystic fibrosis. So they said, you know, we won't give the money to the LGBT community because we have to give it to the cystic fibrosis community. What actually happened was cystic fibrosis organizations and those advocating for PrEP came together and said, this is a nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Which brings us back to that community activism that you were talking about at the beginning.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So then you mentioned climate change and how if we think we've been through the mill with COVID, wait till we get into the heat of battle with this, because over the next 10 years or so are going to be very difficult.
Yeah, like the 21st century, the defining issue of the 21st century is, as far as we know, going to be climate change.
So how then will we use what we learned from HIV and AIDS and COVID to deal with climate change and respond in a scientific way? And we're basing this all around the trust aspect.
Absolutely. And that is it. We need to create a climate of trust. That's the hope, right? Is that if we can come together, we can talk to each other, we can listen to each other's points of view and recognize that people are scared and people don't know what to do. And there isn't a single simple solution to this. It's really complex. So I'm always wary of people who have simple solutions to complex problems. It is a complex problem. It requires a complex response. Mm-hmm. And I think in Ireland, we wouldn't say a silver bullet, but we have a magic formula here, is that we have this capacity to talk to each other. And we do that at a political level using citizens' assemblies. And they have been shown in research, not just in Ireland, but internationally, to be the perfect way for us to bring contentious or controversial issues to a public space and have people talk about it, to hear expert view, but also to hear the views of people with lived experience. People what might have community-based knowledge or a particular perspective, and for us to have to start to trust each other so that we recognise that all of the issues are equally important, experts matter, and that we have to together figure out a way forward.
So you think that the citizens' assembly model builds trust, because some would say, oh, that's just government abdicating responsibility and handing it over to 100 people in a room to make a decision.
I really dislike that model, because if you extend that, you'd say, let's get rid of the media, right? You know, so like or let's get rid of academia. Democracy works because we are all invested in it. The government is not devolving their responsibility by forming citizens' assemblies. They are being informed by it. Mm-hmm. And it's really important that politicians take leadership. Hannah Daly in UCC, who contributes to the podcast, says she worries that things will have to get a lot worse for them to get better when it comes to climate. And I'm curious to know, what will be the thing that turns the tide? What will be the issue that eventually we will recognise that the policies we're using at the moment have us set on a course for disaster, right? And that comes down to us perhaps feeling, I don't know how to respond, it's too big. There is an absence of political leadership in this space. Hannah talks in the podcast about politicians just being too worried to step forward and not knowing, or it becoming a political wedge issue, right? We can see now that some people are trying to position green politics as being on the left. And that's a disaster because, you know, we see in our history, it comes to something like the North, it takes an all of Ireland or an all of humanity response for us to really move forward with mm-hmm. it. That's very important if we're to establish trust.
And then the fear is that if we wait until we can see it, and it's very tangible, and it is certainly tangible in some parts of the world, by then it's too late.
Yeah, and there's analogies in the past. You look at smoking, right? We knew in the 50s that smoking caused death and cancer. And the smoking lobby, the big industries, they paid scientists to lie and to be, fraudsters. And that delayed and seeded doubt. They manufactured doubt so that it has taken, 70 years forward. And we still see the devastating consequences of those decisions. So we have to be really open to the fact that science can be corrupted and that scientists can be dishonest, and that we need to pay huge attention to making sure that we can build a climate of trust. And within my science community, community, we need to be really mindful of how we interact with each other and how we interact with the wider world so that we can be seen to be trustworthy as experts.
It's fascinating, Shane. And the podcast sounds fascinating too. It's called The Trust Race. Dr. Shane Bergen from the UCD School of Education, thank you very much as always for coming into us.